And with that, I'd love to welcome everyone to today's Citizens Climate University, a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is specifically focused on why economists support policies like the Energy Innovation Act. I want to thank you all for joining us. If we've done our job well, after tonight's training, you'll be moved forward arm in arm with the peer-reviewed economics literature community, getting on the same page about what everyone is saying, why they're saying it, and as the details get debated upon, being able to arm yourself with helpful resources. Our speaker tonight is going to help you understand why economists see carbon fee and dividend policies as good for the economy, explain how the Energy Innovation Act corrects prices so that this policy benefits greatly exceed this policy costs, and highlight the shift in economic support based on recent peer-reviewed literature and their rationale. To get us there, our speaker tonight is none other than the wonderful Jerry Hinkle. As an economist, Jerry has long believed that using the market by pricing carbon would be required to adequately address climate change. Jerry began giving public presentations on the risk of climate change in 2001 and lobbying Congress for strong policy in 2006. He's worked as a volunteer on climate issues for a wide variety of national nonprofits in the environmental space, as well as starting Citizens Climate Lobby's Presenters and Schedulers Action Team. He's been the Northern California coordinator with CCL for 6 years and also serves on CCL's board of directors for the last 2 years. Professionally, Jerry has worked as an economist in banking for 35 years and holds MA degrees in economics and in climate policy, as well as publishing several articles in these areas. Our agenda tonight is very straightforward. I'll pass the baton to you, Jerry, in just one moment, and we'll review why economists support this policy, the policy health co-benefits behind it, as well as the climate benefits, and then close on discussing the net policy benefits all from the economics literature. And with that, the floor is yours, Jerry. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
So I just want to welcome everybody. What we're going to talk about tonight is how, in fact, so our case that our legislation is in fact good for the economy and good for society as a whole has never been stronger. Okay. And the two big boosts that we've gotten recently is one, we've got this 3,500 economists that have come out, right, and are essentially standing behind our approach generally to solving the climate crisis. And they're bipartisan, very broad array of really the country and much of the world's finest economists, okay, are saying roughly do it this way. And the other thing is that a key argument for why this is a good thing to do is to reduce or to avoid climate damages. And climate damages have never been more real for the voting public, if you will. Okay, here is the statement, the economist statement. This is on the Climate Leadership Council's website. It came out in a January 16th, 2019 op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And these five principles are the five principles that make up our bill. I'm not going to go over them with you now. You know, use a carbon price, have it be slowly increasing, give all funds back to households, use a CBA. They're all our bill. But these aren't just any economists. These are the four living chair of the Federal Reserve. You know, so these are people from across the political spectrum. You've got Alan Greenspan, Paul Volcker on the right. You've got Janet Yellen on the left, 27 Nobel Prize winners, and the chairs. This is the chief economic advisor to the president of the United States for every president since Ford, except for Carter. That's a story we don't need to get into. But Dems, Republicans, it's commonly agreed that this is generally the right way to go. Why? Here's their fundamental argument. And this is the Pigouvian thing. But I want to lay it out clearly here. And the good news is you can keep this in your back pocket. We're not walking into meetings with this. But the carbon price helps resolve a market failure by correcting prices and the corresponding misallocation of resources. What do I mean? Picture the person 3 decades ago going up to the counter to buy a pack of cigarettes. Okay. The pack of cigarettes costs about $1. And the costs there are the tobacco, packaging, and then maybe a little bit of money for the Joe Camel ads, right? That person would then consume the product, and it somewhat likely at some point in the future, they would come down with terrible diseases like lung cancer, throat cancer, emphysema. Now, this would be associated with really expensive healthcare costs. The individual would pay some of those, but very often, they would be born by society. They would be born by Medicare, Medi-Cal. You and I end up paying these. And what the economists brought to the table was, look, you can dramatically improve the allocation of resources by correcting the price. They shouldn't be seeing just a dollar. You need to reflect in that market price, internalize to the market price, some of these social or external costs, okay? We did that. Cigarettes went up in price substantially. And as a result, cigarette smoking went well down, okay? And so what economists would say is, this increases social welfare. We're better off. Okay. A question that I want you to ponder is, what happened to GDP? So we've invoked this policy. We put a healthy sin tax on cigarettes. Okay. And then we did something with the money. What happened to GDP? Don't know, not much. Not going to be a big impact on GDP. Okay, taxes are fundamentally bad for GDP is gross domestic product. It is the sum of the value of all products produced in a given year. So, the tax is going to hurt GDP. It depends on what we spent the money on. So, does that mean we're not sure whether it's good for the economy? No, that's like my exclamation mark there. No, we're clear it's good for the economy because we have less of this smoking and lung cancer, and we're spending a whole lot less money on this, various treatments for these terrible diseases. Okay, so not sure what happened to GDP, but we know it increased social welfare. We're better off. That's a good thing. Okay. Fast forward to fossil fuels. Same story. Okay. We consume these, but the pump only reflects the private costs, not some of these social costs. If we raise the price, if we put a tax, a Pigouvian tax, on fossil fuel emissions, then we're going to correct prices. Prices will begin to reflect some of the damages done. And we're going to get less of this, right? This is the Midwest currently. This is Paradise, California. And when we look at the economic costs here, I'm trying to make a point that the costs of the extreme weather really goes well beyond what we can count financially. People's lives are altered. I live in California. We don't look at summer the same way, okay? Most of us. People are greatly concerned and we have to live with that. We've got less of this. This is Hurricane Harvey. So interesting side note here on GDP, gross domestic product. Picture Hurricane Harvey coming through Houston, huge, very highly populous city. Really does an extensive amount of damages. Okay, if the hurricane comes through and then you spend an enormous amount of money cleaning up from the damages, that's that cleaning up, that's a product. That's going to bolster GDP. Then if you rebuild the housing, you simply just put it back to the way it was before, it's a significant increase in GDP. Are we any better off? No. Right? You just put the city, you just put the city back together again. GDP is not a measure of welfare. And where we want to point to say that this is good for the economy and society is to look at measures of welfare. Okay. And this is crop damage from a drought. So we will avoid, if we correct the price of fossil fuel emissions, we're going to get a whole lot less of the bad thing, and we're going to get a lot more of this. That's just what the market will bring if prices are correct. If the cost of the product reflects not just those internal costs of the oil and refining the gas and then shipping it to the gas station, but of those social external costs as well. Okay, so that's where we're trying to get. That's the economist's justification. But I don't want you going into members of Congress talking about PIGU. How we generally evaluate policy is to do cost-benefit analysis. So what we want to, and that's how we want to rationalize and say that we're certain. You know, that's how we want to say we're certain that this is good for the economy and society. What are the benefits? The benefits are not just climate benefits, reduced damages from extreme weather, et cetera, reduced agricultural yields. There are also substantial health benefits. Okay, then we'll look at the costs as well. This is from, I've got the sources at the bottom of the slide. Drew Schindel, both in 2014 and 2016, looked at the general benefits or the health costs of air pollution generally. And so you can read it here, 114,000 premature deaths, non-fatal heart attacks, hospitalizations. Half of these are children's hospitalizations from asthma, lost work days, lost school days. The World Bank estimated in 2013, that's just the year that they chose, for North America as a whole, that air pollution cost almost 3% of GDP. That's quite expensive. Schindel came back, and again, you know, top journal, this is Nature Climate Change. Got that as February 2016. Great study for us, because he looked at what would be the benefits of a climate policy that was consistent with a 2-degree temperature rise. Well, if some of you saw Rick Knight's presentation at the conference, you'll have seen that our bill will get you somewhere between 1.5C and 2C. So ours is going to do a little bit better than this. Okay, yes, I know you need international action consistent with, but that doesn't matter here. The emissions reductions will reduce all of these air pollution costs to some degree. His estimates, it will prevent 36,000 premature deaths a year. And this is the one he can value. And he values that at $250 billion. Reduce children's ER asthma visits, reduce adult lost work days. What he wasn't even able to account was the non-fatal heart attacks, hospitalizations. 2 points. One, $250 billion a year is a lot of money. We'll put it in appropriate context in a minute. And it's a very conservative estimate. You're going to have far greater health co-benefits that what we can currently readily value. But our policy is going to get you $250 billion pretty much right away in health benefits. That's significant. People understand that. Okay. It's important to the economic justice or the environmental justice community. It's salient and important to people. Now let's go to climate damages. I'm hoping that you find this graph useful. Sometimes statistics can tell a very compelling story. I think that is the case here. So NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmosphere Administration, I would not want to try that saying that more than once. You know, every year, and many of you have seen this, they put together a report of the $1 billion or more weather and climate disasters and the cost of them. Okay. And this is in constant 2019 dollars. So this is inflation adjusted. So what I've done here is take the average number of such events and cost of those events per year by decade, right? So you got 10 years in the 80s, and this is the average per year. Because if you just did the individual years, it'd be very noisy. It's very important here. You have some really bad years and bad events, very costly events. Katrina, boom, right? So this smooths the data, and you've got a very compelling picture here. And what it tells us is that the cost of weather and climate disasters each year has steadily risen pretty dramatically. It was $17 billion a year in the 80s. And again, inflation-adjusted basis, it's $83 billion a year this decade. Okay? If you took just the last 5 years and averaged that, it would be over $100 billion a year. So this is getting very costly. People know that. Here's the numbers and the pictures that show you that. So consider this. So temperatures really started rising in the 80s. The temperature rise between the 80s and now is pretty just under 1 degree centigrade. So over this period, temps up 1 degree centigrade, the costs on average per year up almost 500%. And the number of events, that's the green line, up over 400%. Very telling picture. Now, NOAA will mention when they write this up, and you'll hear, especially from opponents to our approach, wait a minute. Part of the reason that damages are up is because there is greater vulnerability and exposure as well as climate change. So let's think about this. What is vulnerability and exposure? What they mean is you got a hurricane coming through, but this decade, there's a lot more housing and people there. There's a lot more stuff that gets in the way. How much more stuff relative to the 80s? Well, I would look at two things. One is the population increase. Population's up 38% over this period. Okay, that's a lot, but it isn't 500%. Something else is going on. It's nowhere near. Housing is up probably 30 to 40% in value on the value of the average home on an inflation adjusted basis. So look at those factors are contributing, but there is a big 800-pound gorilla in this room. And it is climate change. By the way, it's a good time to tell you, I will be writing all this up and you will have it. Okay, now what we're gonna do is try to value the climate damages. And that's done through a concept called the social cost of carbon. And it's very challenging. But what you do is you estimate damages going forward for many, many decades, and then you discount them back. And everything on that you're seeing here, well, generally discounted back at 3%. Okay, so I want to go over two estimates. They're wildly different, and you'll get very different estimates. There's kind of an official estimate, and it's used in some research I'm about to show you. So don't worry about the details here. Here's what I want you to know. The U.S. government had a, with the EPA, had an interagency working group. Most of the work's done in 2010, so it's a while ago. Updated a bit in 2016. What they came up with is that the social cost of carbon, the value of avoided damages for 1 ton of carbon equivalent emissions is $48 a ton. Okay. Experts generally agree. There is a consensus, if you will. This is very conservative. Nordhaus, right, won the Nobel Prize a few months back for this type of work, says it could be three times this. Why? Because there's a lot that is not included. There's a lot of damages that are not included. The only thing that is included are those things that are readily quantifiable. Okay, so there's no ecosystem damage. You can read this, okay? Much of the recent extreme weather costs are not well reflected at all in these models. Okay, there's a lot that's missing, and I've got this quote at the bottom, or from The Economist. You know, war, what's that cost you? Well, they were more likely in the past and will be more likely in the future as a result of climate change. You know, it's true. When people get desperate, they do desperate things. So I'm going to compare that to another, again, top journal, Catherine Rick, Nature Climate Change, very recent, September. This is a much more comprehensive, you're getting my view here. This is absolutely peer-reviewed, great journal, but I think this is a much more comprehensive and realistic estimate. And what she found, or they found, was that the social cost of carbon, the damages to the U.S. only were worth 48 a ton. Global damages were 417 a ton. I would argue global is what we care about because we would not want other countries like China doing something that caused damage to us without taking responsibility for it. I would not think that we would not want to ignore damage that we were doing to others. But currently there in Republican circles, there's an argument that let's look at US only. So let's call this a band, okay? From $48 a ton to $417. Let's say that's a reasonable band of the cost in terms of future damages of greenhouse gas emissions. Okay. What that would imply, if you look at the line below, so Colombia has come out with a report evaluating our policy, and they're going to say our policy will reduce emissions 1.3 billion tons by 2030. If you translate that to a dollar value based on Rick's social cost of carbon, you get a range of $62 billion to $540 billion a year. Okay, are you with me so far? I'm hoping you are, and we'll find out more in the questions. Okay, what are the policy costs? This is a new concept for us, okay? The best one way to estimate policy costs is to estimate any change in GDP. Just like with cigarettes, what happens to GDP? It depends on what you do with the money, okay? If you're gonna raise a tax, you're going to get more of a break even or even a benefit if you take that money and reduce a tax, especially capital, taxes on capital, taxes on income, payroll taxes. different folks get different estimates. That's a long story. Columbia is going to say our policy is going to reduce GDP 0.2 to 0.4%. And if you went to Noah Kaufman's presentation on Monday, then you saw this. That's 40 to 80 billion a year. Now, does that mean our policy is bad for the economy? Absolutely not. Again, we're correcting prices. We're correcting a misallocation of resources. We're going to get a whole lot less climate damages to spend our money on, and a whole lot more low carbon technology and the like. So know this about his GDP estimate and what comes out here. It doesn't include the health benefits. It doesn't include the climate benefits. It's very narrow. If you included these, you'd almost certainly get GDP to rise. In fact, some parties are now, on a peer-reviewed basis, doing exactly this. They're making attempts to calculate the change in GDP of a revenue-neutral carbon tax should you include these climate and health benefits. And GDP is going to be just fine. This is a little different. Remy said that GDP increases. The peer-reviewed literature does not. Now, let me say that more carefully. The peer-reviewed literature says if you raise a tax, a carbon tax, and you take the funds and hand them to households, GDP is going to fall slightly. Remy said that GDP increases, and Remy differed from the peer-reviewed literature from that. Okay, deep breath. Now I want to show you the cost-benefit analysis as done in some great peer-reviewed literature. This is a great book. So often you'll see an article evaluating revenue neutral carbon tax. This is a whole 350-page book, and these are very important people: Larry Golder, been at this for decades, Stanford University, Mark Halfstead works for Resources for the Future. They built a model and analyzed fully a revenue neutral carbon tax. Theirs is smaller than ours. It starts at $20 a ton and rises gradually from there, but much slower than ours. Page 117. Here you go. Here's the bottom line analysis in terms of cost benefit analysis. So they're not looking at GDP, the top row here, welfare costs. They're looking at how basically consumption will decline. And let me answer the question, why does GDP fall if you give money back to people? It falls because you're causing the economy, you're causing producers to shift to slightly more expensive sources of energy. So you're gonna get a small cost. This is in trillions over time, discounted back at 3%. So this looks like a lot of money, but this covers a long time period. So the costs are 3.3 trillion. The climate benefits are almost twice that at 5.6 billion. The health benefits, I've got in yellow there, about 8.5 trillion, about almost three times. Okay, so total benefits, 14 trillion. Costs, 3.3, benefits, 14.2 trillion. Here's the bottom line from Golder Halfstead, and they're right there with most other folks. The policy benefits divided by the costs, the benefits are over four times the costs. Okay, and the social cost of carbon estimate that they are using is that 48, not the 417. They're using the EPA's estimate of $48 a ton. So I'm very sure, and most experts would agree, the 4.24, that the benefits are over four times the cost, very conservative. Now, I want to look at our policy, and when I'm done with this, I'm done, so we can get straight to questions. And I know this is thick material. I appreciate you hanging with me. It's going to be important in the days ahead, and it's all going to be written up, and so you'll have reference material. You'll have a reference document. So for our bill, roughly, what are the health co-benefits? The top row, about $250 billion a year, and it's 1.2% of 2018 GDP. What are the climate benefits? I'm giving you the RIC range here, 48 to 417 per ton. If we reduce emissions 1.3 billion tons by 2030, okay, what we've got is climate benefits of 62 to 540 billion. That means total benefits from a policy like ours by the year 2030, 312 to 790 billion. Okay. Now compare that to the policy cost of 40 to 80 billion. Way, way bigger. About, if we focus on the 80 billion cost and say that's the one, then it's about 4 to 10 times bigger. Lot of numbers. Fun for me. I love numbers. Not everybody does. Here's the point. The benefit to the economy and society of our policy is many, many multiples of the very small cost. This analysis is not peer-reviewed. It's based all on peer-reviewed literature, though. So what are my summary points? You may hear going forward, especially as the bill garners more support and becomes a real threat to opponents, that it's not good for the economy. It's a job killer. We've heard that before. Horse dung, we know it's good for the economy. And you can rely on the cost-benefit analysis to rationalize that, to explain that. And if you don't believe me, ask 3,500 of my closest friends from across the political spectrum. You can use their statement. That's very credible stuff. Number two, policy benefits greater than the cost. This is a win for the economy and the environment. And now, and I'm excited about this, we're walking forward with the peer-reviewed science and economic literature, arm in arm with the peer-reviewed community. These folks are on our side. They're advocating for what we're advocating for. They know this is the right thing for the economy and the society.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this thorough presentation and that rousing summary, Jerry. We have here on this slide your contact information. If anyone would like to get in touch with Jerry after this and discuss further details, his email is simply jerry@citizensclimate.org. And if anyone has questions, we do encourage you to also pose them on CCL Communities forums. The link to that page on our website is listed here, because if you have a question, chances are others do as well, and you're welcome to search for what others have asked and been responded to in the past. And we also want to highlight the important work that our Economics Policy Network Action Team is doing. So that link is there. You're more than welcome to join the discussion that over a dozen of CCL's volunteers, who are also economists throughout the country, have been enriching our volunteer learning community with the white papers and research that they're doing. So let's close with this. The recent Nobel economist William Nordhaus had this to say about the challenge that we face. There are billions of individuals, millions of firms, thousands of governments, hundreds of nations, and for them to take action, they are going to have incentives. We can raise the price of goods and services that are carbon intensive, and through supporting policies like the Energy Innovation Act, get us to a point where we leverage the power of the market and our broad economy to do what's right and address climate change. Thank you all for joining us tonight. We look forward to seeing you soon, and have a wonderful rest of the evening.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you so much. You're-